Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to the Karma You podcast. This is your host, Chloe Brotheridge. I'm a coach, a hypnotherapist, and I'm the author of The Anxiety Solution and Brave New Girl. And this podcast is all about helping you to become your calmest, happiest, and most confident self. Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Karma You podcast. I took a little break over the summer from recording episodes. It started to take over a little bit. I needed a break. I needed to catch up on recording and reading people's books to interview them and that sort of thing. So it's been great to have some time off. I still am between homes of no fixed abode, currently in Cornwall again, staying at my boyfriend's mum's place, which is very lovely, and hoping to move into a place around October in the north of England. So it's a big change from London to Bali to Cornwall to the north of England where I grew up. But yeah, it's all good. And the podcast is going to be back now and regular episodes every Monday. So keep an eye out for those. So today on the podcast, I'm talking to Naomi Shragai, who has a new book out called The Man Who Mistook His Job for His Life. She's an executive coach. She's a psychological business consultant and a qualified psychotherapist with over 30 years experience. And we get into all sorts of topics. She tells us about what stand-up comedy taught her, basically my worst nightmare. And she is extremely brave, in my view. Anyone who does stand-up comedy, incredibly brave. But she shares about what this taught her and what it can teach all of us. We spoke about what it means to be hijacked by strong feelings. We've all had that, haven't we? Where a feeling seems to pop up out of nowhere and suddenly it's like you're out of control. You're reacting. You're saying something you don't want to say. You're feeling something so strongly that it's like it pulls you off centre. And we talk about that and what we can do about those moments when that happens to us. We talk about imposter syndrome, and she has a really interesting perspective on this, about how it might not be a fear of failure, but actually a fear of something else. And I thought this is fascinating. We also get into, this is such a popular topic at the moment, I'm noticing, what is the difference between a productive narcissist and a pathological narcissist? I didn't even realise there was a difference, or I didn't know what that was, but she explains it, how to spot them, what to do if you have a narcissistic boss. It's very, very interesting. So I hope you like this episode. So welcome, Naomi. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
Yes, very well, thank you. Nice to see you.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you do and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Well, I'm a psychotherapist. I've been a psychotherapist for over 30 years. But for the last sort of 15 years or so, more and more people have been bringing more work-related issues to my consulting room. You know, they're just feeling more vulnerable at work. I think with the change of work culture, the insecurity of work, the competitiveness, just the change of culture, people were just feeling more vulnerable and they wanted to talk about it. And I realized, you know, some years ago that this was an area that people weren't really talking about, the deeper kind of psychological motivations behind their work-related problems. So I began writing about some of these themes for the Financial Times, I think perhaps about 10 years ago. So my earliest features were about dealing with difficult bosses, narcissistic bosses, having difficult conversations, people's difficulty in delegating work, and perhaps what were the underlying motivations for that. So I started writing these features and had quite a big reaction in the paper. and subsequently in my practice as well. So I've since specialized in helping people to understand the psychological dynamics behind their work-related issues, interpersonal problems, personal issues. Why were they sabotaging their work? You know, oftentimes what happens is people, they know their habits are undermining their work. So they know that their perfectionism is causing a problem. They know that their colleagues are getting irritated, and they know they're not getting much done in the process, but they feel compelled to stop. They feel compelled to carry on, and unable to stop. So those are the sorts of things I'm interested in. Why people repeat behaviors that they know are undermining and sabotaging their work, but they just can't stop. And oftentimes it's because it's something they haven't understood deeply enough. So they might be getting all the right advice, and all the advice is very well-meaning, but with the best advice in the world, they feel compelled to carry on. So that's where I come in. So in a sense, that's where I am today. Yeah,
so interesting. And I know we all have those things, don't we? It's almost like the kind of the, I often think about this as being like such a universal thing of humans. It's like, we know we should be doing something differently, but somehow we can't seem to change things. We feel really stuck, or we're in this repeating pattern. And yeah, I've definitely noticed from people that I've spoken to how work is such a source of stress or anxiety or, you know, insecurity for people, and what a big impact it has on our lives, our work. And yeah, so it doesn't surprise me that you're seeing, you know, more and more people coming to you for this.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
So you've got a new book out called The Man Who Mistook His Job for His Life. Can you tell us what that is about and what made you want to write the book?
Well, I guess the book is a continuation of my work and the work that I've been involved in for, I guess, some over 15 years now, which is how to understand people's work-related problems by understanding their unconscious motivations. But it's really by digging deeply and oftentimes into their childhood. So the book is packed with intimate stories about people's working lives, but it's not just their working lives, but it's retracing their problems to their earliest family experiences, and coming to understand how your very early experiences start to have a profound influence in terms of how you relate in the workplace. Not just how you relate in the workplace, but also about your deepest vulnerabilities. You know, oftentimes work is a place that we try to resolve some of our earliest conflicts, but of course, oftentimes that creates more problems than it solves. So the book is an extension of my work. It's as I say, full of case studies, which are quite interesting, and hopefully a lot of insights to help people understand, you know, some of the confusing dynamics in the workplace, helping people to understand what's behind some of the typical personality clashes that we experience, why people struggle with conflict, how to understand irrational behavior, our own and that of our colleagues and bosses, how to deal with difficult bosses. So I hope it's packed with some of the more, you know, common issues that people struggle with in the workplace.
Yeah, that's something that I really loved about the book, the storytelling and how many different stories there are, and how, you know, every story there might be something that I can relate to in there that's kind of showing me something about myself and highlighting something. So it was really, really powerful how you did that. So yeah, one of the stories that you share, which is one of your own stories, is about how you have done stand-up comedy. And I have to say, stand-up comedy is probably my worst nightmare. I'm pretty sure I have had nightmares about it, about having to do it. I've never done it before, but I'm curious to know from you, what was your experience of that, and what did that teach you?
Well, that's what most people say to me when they hear that I've done stand-up comedy. Of course, it was many years ago. It was more than 20 years ago, so it's quite a long time ago. It was back in the 90s, and quite some time. And of course, for most people, it is their worst nightmare. You know, why would anybody risk that kind of rejection and humiliation on stage? Because of course, when things go wrong, they're absolutely excruciating. And as you see in the book, I've written something about that experience, just how awful it can be. But of course, there's the opposite experience, that when it's going well and people are laughing and your performance is going down a storm, it genuinely feels like you're loved it does feel that way. And so it becomes very compelling. You want to recapture that feeling over and over again. And of course, I don't think I'm different than many stand-up comics to say that one of the things I'm looking for in performance is, you know, to be loved, to be liked, to be applauded, you know, all of those good feelings. So that's, of course, what that drive can be so strong that it can compel you to go back on stage, even after a death or just an excruciating performance.
Yeah, so, so interesting. And
yeah,
I know you talk about it being, I think this is what stand-up comedies call it, like you die on stage if you bomb or you get booed or something. They call it a death. And I suppose, you know, surviving that experience, surviving a death, you know, it's got to give you a lot of resilience, I would imagine.
Well, it gives you resilience in the sense that, you know, although it's excruciating, well, first of all, you know, it doesn't kill you. You know, you can bear it. And the other thing is, even though you've had a death, the drive to get back on and do better and overcome it and have a fabulous performance. I mean, that drive is so strong that it can overcome that fear of rejection. In fact, it's really that powerful. So it does give you an enormous amount of resilience, I have to say. And I guess I would advise anybody who's considering a career in stand-up comedy, I would say that surviving rejection, being able to deal with rejection, getting back on stage after the most excruciating death is perhaps the most important skill to have above anything else. Because if you can't get back on stage, then your career is cut short. But it's interesting because I think that resilience, that ability to overcome rejection, to overcome setbacks, is equally what people need in any career, really. You know, the capacity to get over a setback, to tolerate really horrible feelings and still persevere is what's required in most professions.
Absolutely, yeah. And I know from my own work, you know, when you work for yourself, you know, you're your own boss and you're the one putting yourself out there and the one getting rejected. Like I was telling one of my friends, oh, I got rejected about 5 times today. How was your day? But it does teach you that, you know, you can try things and you can survive. And I imagine doing something like, whether it's regular old public speaking or stand-up comedy or anything like that, where you're really putting yourself out there, yeah, must teach you a lot about how you don't die if someone says no. You don't die if people boo you off stage. It might be, you know, painful, but it's not gonna kill you. And what you're saying, it sounds like, is really important to try again and to go out there and kind of prove to yourself that you can get through it.
Absolutely.
One of the things you talk about in the book is, you know, when we get hijacked by strong feelings. And can you share what you mean by that and maybe some examples of when that might happen for people? And, you know, what can we do when we find ourselves getting hijacked by strong feelings in that way?
Well, yes, it's very, very common experience. Basically, what I'm referring to is when people are overwhelmed by strong feelings. So they're overtaken by fear. It might be jealousy or envy. It might be resentment. You know, for some people in the workplace, you know, it could be as strong as rage. And these feelings can be so powerful that they can distort our thinking. So, you know, just because you have a strong feeling, it doesn't mean that your strong feeling is accurate. You know, because feelings can be misleading too. So just because you're feeling, let's say, envious or you're feeling resentful, yeah, it may not be accurate, but if the feeling's very strong, you can lose your sense of judgment because feelings can overtake our capacity to perceive and think clearly and also to respond appropriately. So what I refer to by being hijacked by strong feelings is when our feelings overtake us and overwhelm us and distort our better judgment. So sometimes, for example, we might know that we need to ask for help in the workplace, but we're so terrified of exposing, let's say, a weakness, or we just feel so uncomfortable asking for help that our fear overtakes our better judgment. And that's what I mean when I say hijacked by strong feelings.
Yeah, Yeah, I can. I'm just sort of thinking about different times when I may have been hijacked by strong feelings, when it's only looking back that you realise you were being irrational. At the time, you're indignant, or you think that you're right, or you think that this is a, you know, if you're angry about something, for example, it can seem at the time like, yes, this is justified. But actually looking back, you realise maybe it isn't. And yeah, our thoughts, our feelings are not necessarily telling us the truth when we're, when particularly if it harks back to an old wound or an old pain. I know you talk a lot about that in the book. Yeah, so it's horrible when that happens. It's horrible. But yeah, what can people do in those moments? Is it like, is there something we can do in those moments to help it? Or is it something we do beforehand to prepare for that?
Well, oftentimes the feelings can take us by surprise. Do you know that feeling when suddenly you're alarmed because you're suddenly overtaken with rage, perhaps, or resentment, or just, you just feel so hostile towards somebody, and you're kind of struck and even surprised by your own reaction and your own strong feeling. You can hardly believe yourself, or hardly believe how unfair you can be in judging other people. You can even, you know, judge yourself harshly for that, but you kind of can't help it. It's quite powerful. I think one of the things to say is, in those moments, it's, you know, quite important to be able to learn to contain your feelings and not act on them. When feelings are quite strong, yeah, they can be misleading and taking us down some strange rabbit hole. So the important thing is to learn to contain feelings, to sit with them, to consider them, and more importantly, not act on them. If you're feeling, let's say, quite resentful towards a colleague in the workplace, before you say anything or do anything that might cause more harm or damage, because perhaps your feelings are misleading you, the important thing is to sit with those feelings. Take some time and try to reflect and consider where those feelings are coming from. Now, it might be, and you've seen this in the book, of course, that some of these feelings can actually be located from our earliest experiences and early lives, so that they're triggering perhaps even early traumas in our lives. So we're not being traumatized in the workplace, but it can feel as if we are. So being ignored in the workplace, for example, can feel uncomfortable. But if it feels that you're being traumatized, or you feel traumatized, it's a good indication that your feelings are misleading you. You need to stop. You need to contain your feelings. You need to reflect on those feelings. Now, oftentimes, our own minds, when we're hijacked by our feelings, are of little use, because oftentimes what happens in our minds is we repeat some monologue in our head. We have an explanation or a story that we repeat to ourselves. But if our own stories are not helpful, because they can be misleading us as well, it's important to gain perspective, you know, to speak to somebody, you know, perhaps a coach or a psychotherapist or a close ally, or speak to somebody to help you gain perspective and, you know, to gain some clarity. So I guess what it boils down to is containing your feelings and then gaining perspective and developing some insight into understanding what those strong feelings are about. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I think, yeah, definitely telling someone about it. Sometimes just saying it out loud, you hear it said out loud and you just get a different perspective on it, because you kind of externalize it. Or getting someone else's input onto something can just help us to reframe it and to see it differently before we, you know, I'm thinking about like getting an email, and before you like angrily reply to that email, you know, taking a moment, sitting with the feelings and maybe talking to someone about it. If you're noticing that it's like it's triggering something old from the past or something that seems excessive for the situation.
That's right. And one of the things I talk about a lot is that I think this capacity and ability to sit with and tolerate strong feelings is an enormously underestimated skill. You know, if we can't tolerate a feeling, we're much more likely to act on it. If we act on it, we're much more likely to do some harm or damage as a result. So having a capacity to sit with uncomfortable feelings is so important and so crucial. And unfortunately, in the current culture, there's a sort of a belief that we shouldn't have bad feelings, or that situations shouldn't upset us. But of course they do, because that's life, and things happen. And not just things happen in life, but things happen more importantly internally inside ourselves. And of course, strong feelings and uncomfortable feelings emerge. So being able to deal with them. And oftentimes what I talk about is developing a sort of emotional muscle. And what I mean about that is when strong feelings erupt, if you can sit with them and tolerate them, you're somehow beginning to build the muscle that's required in order to tolerate these feelings. And that kind of can build over time. And each time we act on those feelings, we lose that capacity. You know, we say to ourselves, I can't cope with these feelings. I can't deal with them. And you have to get rid of them. Now, when people get rid of bad feelings, oftentimes, well, they can act on them, which sometimes cause harm. But the other thing can happen is they can act them out passive aggressively in the workplace. So, you know, if they're feeling resentful or whatever it might be, hostile, anger, hatred, all sorts of uncomfortable feelings happen in the workplace. And if they don't have a way of tolerating and managing and understanding their feelings, they're much more likely to be acted out passive aggressively in the workplace. And this is oftentimes what's behind, let's say, malicious gossip or the sorts of behaviors that undermine work, you know, withholding information from colleagues, for example, not supporting them in a way that they need, or missing meetings, or just missing work. So if feelings can't be tolerated, there's quite a lot of consequences to that. It's just so important.
Yeah. So if we don't kind of manage our own feelings or allow ourselves to sit with them and process them, then it'll come out in another way. We'll either, I don't know. Yeah. It'll leak out in passive aggression or mean gossip or something like that. So learning how to sort of tolerate and hold our own feelings and deal with them in a healthy way. Now, this episode of the Karma You podcast is sponsored by my 5-day anxiety challenge. Now, this anxiety challenge is for you if you are a world-class overthinker and you find it hard to switch off at the end of the day. It's for you if your mind automatically goes to the worst-case scenario whenever you're doing something new or different. If you struggle with a voice in your head that criticizes your every move, if you find it hard to be present because you're busy worrying and second-guessing yourself, or if you wake up at 5 a.m. with a racing heart, adrenaline pumping, and a sense of dread in your stomach about the day ahead. In this 5-day challenge, I give you a daily exercise that will help you to tune in to a calmer version of yourself. There's a hypnotherapy session in there to help you to feel calmer instantly. I'm sharing my favourite tool for releasing stress and tension from the body, and lots more. Plus, you get a special invite to invite your friends to do the challenge for free, because sharing is caring and group support is invaluable. You can join the anxiety challenge today. It's $4.99 to join. You get to keep it forever and do it as many times as you want. You can head over to karma-u.com/anxiety-challenge, all one word. So that's karma-u.com/anxiety-challenge, all one word. I hope you like it.
It's gonna, absolutely.
Yeah, but we're not really taught that, are we? We're not taught that. That's why we need people like you in our lives. So I was wondering about imposter syndrome. This is such a big topic. I feel like everyone's talking about imposter syndrome in the last couple of years. It's much more something that we're aware of. And I love that you talk about it in terms of, you know, perhaps it's not actually a fear of failure. Perhaps it's a fear of success. Can you share what you mean by that?
Yes, it can be. I mean, you know, most people, when they think about imposter syndrome, first of all, most people get imposter syndrome, I think it's misunderstood. Everyone says sort of imposter syndrome as if it's something that everybody has. But of course, it means something differently for everyone. So there's, you know, on the milder end of imposter syndrome, of course, it's quite useful because all it is self-doubt. Well, if you're in a new role or new position, new at your job, well, why shouldn't you doubt yourself? That feels perfectly healthy, realistic, and quite normal. And it might be that there are some things that, yes, you do need to learn, or you do need to develop particular skills. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that's one thing to say. Of course, if you go on to the extreme end, you know, those feelings can undermine your decisions and behavior. So, you know, we're talking about something else. So, but you asked another question, which was more to do with it not being a fear of failure, but a fear of success. And I think the fear of success is more deeply unconscious. So while consciously we might be aware of a fear of failure, most people might say, oh, I don't want to fail. I think the fear of success for many people, is more unconscious. So, you know, because if we think about it, failure, although it might feel bad, it also provides a kind of a get-out clause. So for people who find themselves in a position, perhaps they're in a new role or newly promoted, you know, the idea of a get-out clause is quite enticing if you think about it. So they might, for example, unconsciously struggle with delegating work, undermining their work, so that in fact they don't succeed. Because remember that success brings with it more responsibility, more decisions to make, more people to piss off, and ultimately more exposure. And with that more exposure comes more anxiety. And with that anxiety comes more imposter feelings. So you can see why success actually can be quite a terrifying prospect for people who fear exposure. Mm. And there are deeper, I think, more, again, unconscious motivations for why people might fear success. You know, for some people, they fear overtaking their parents. You know, they can't quite allow themselves to have a better life than their parents, you know, because that generation, perhaps their parents hadn't had the opportunity to enjoy their career, to be financially secure, to have all the better things in life. And overtaking one's parents, you know, for some people, leaves them ridden with guilt, particularly if they imagine that their parents had quite unhappy lives, quite sad lives. So there's those underlying feelings of guilt, a kind of a survivor guilt for doing better than one's parents. Mm. But oftentimes those motivations, again, run more deeply.
So interesting. Yeah. So the fear of failure might be more on the surface, that we're kind of might be more aware of that, but this fear of success could be more unconscious and actually be sabotaging you and causing you to... yeah, sabotage yourself or doubt yourself or hold yourself back in some way.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I spoke to one woman and it was quite interesting because she had, she came from a working class background and her mother hadn't been educated. Her mother was actually quite angry about having to be a stay-at-home mum and raise children, because she wanted to go out and to work. And so, you know, when my client found that work was so satisfying, she could, you know, she could hardly bear it, you know, to think that she had the things that her mother wished for. Mm. I think that's a theme that I come across with my clients quite a lot. You know, it's hard to overcome those feelings of guilt for doing better than one's mother or father in that regard.
So interesting. So interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I suppose another thing I wanted to talk to you about was, and you mentioned this, you touched on this in the beginning, narcissism. Narcissism, which I think is like a big trendy, it seems like a trendy topic. Like there's so many YouTube videos about narcissists, I've noticed, and lots of people talking about this. But you talk about the difference between a productive narcissist and a pathological narcissist. So there are different types. Can you explain what that is? Can you explain, first of all, what a narcissist is, maybe for people that don't know?
Well, you're right that it's so popular. The term seems to be thrown around all the time.
Everyone's calling their ex-boyfriend a narcissist, basically. I don't think it's very fair. They can't all be.
That's right. People say it about everyone. I think Trump has really popularized the term, hasn't he? So suddenly everybody's a narcissist. So suddenly, if anybody is self-interested or ambitious, or basically, I think it's anybody that makes us unhappy, we accuse them of being a narcissist. It just gets thrown all over the place. And as if everybody's a narcissist, but not us, everyone else is, because they've made us unhappy. But of course, that's not the case. It's become such a popular phrase. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that we all have a degree of narcissism. Narcissism isn't personality type. It's not something that somebody catches or somebody becomes. You know, narcissism is, I guess, a trait that, you know, we all have a degree of it. In fact, we couldn't go very far without some narcissism, because somewhere it's the self-belief we have in ourselves. If we didn't have a degree of narcissism, we wouldn't have the confidence to go for that job promotion, for example, or to take risks, or we couldn't function very well without it. So a degree of narcissism is not just helpful, it's quite crucial. So if we can begin by understanding that we all have narcissism, but then the other thing to understand is that narcissism itself runs along a very long continuum. So at one end is what we call more healthy and productive narcissists. And these are people that, yes, they have a certain sense of self-belief, a strong self-belief. They also usually are quite intelligent, and they can, you know, they know how to get people behind them. You know, they are good leaders. And we refer to them as productive narcissists because these people get things done. So in the workplace, they're, you know, good to have on board. So there are people who have a degree of narcissism, and they're quite good leaders. I mean, you have to have some narcissism to get into a position of leadership. Without that degree of narcissism, you really couldn't get very far. So there are people who have that narcissism, and we call them quite productive. Now, at that level, these people are still quite empathetic. They can still be very supportive of people in the team and appreciate that if some people have good ideas, well, if it's for the good of the company, that leader could back those ideas, so to speak. Now, on the more extreme end, when we talk about malignant narcissists, when we talk about pathological narcissists, how people perhaps refer to Trump when it becomes more of a kind of, I guess some people might say, a mental illness, I think that's when you have to make a distinction between a productive and a pathological or malignant narcissism. And the difference is in a capacity to empathize, because on the extreme end, those narcissists have no capacity for empathy. Everything is about them. They're quite willing to take your ideas and make them their own. They have no interest in helping their team. And they oftentimes surround themselves with people who simply back them or believe them, rather than having a diverse team. So, you know, these are people who can be quite destructive in business, quite dangerous. And the other thing to say about these people is they're, the more extremely narcissistic they are, the more fragile their personalities. So one way to understand narcissism is a kind of defense against feelings of fragility. So the more fragile they are, the more rigid their narcissistic defense. And because they're so rigid, they have to rid themselves of their own feelings of inadequacy. And the way they do this oftentimes is by bullying and harming people close to them, if you can understand. So that's why they become so harmful in the workplace. So there are sometimes these extremely narcissistic bosses in the workplace. However, I have to say, they're very few and far between. So be careful about accusing your boss of being a narcissist simply because he doesn't back your ideas, or he seems to be, you know, quite full of himself. You know, so the other thing to remember about these narcissistic bosses, oftentimes they're very intelligent. They're very successful. They're very good at inspiring people and getting people to be inspired about their work. So there's very good traits that they bring to the workplace as well. And it's useful to appreciate that. You know, sometimes I say to people, because people times often ask, well, how do you live with a narcissistic boss? Well, one thing to do is to appreciate the good things that they bring to the business. And the other thing is to keep in mind that the more extreme their narcissism, the deeper their fragility, because it might help you to be a bit more compassionate towards them and understanding. So you might be able to get along. Of course, at the very, very, very extreme end, you may just need to get another job because they can be so damaging.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting you say about being careful about labeling people as narcissists. I think it is something that's getting thrown around so much that it probably discredits the term or something. It kind of waters it down. Maybe if everyone, you know, everyone's labeling their boss and their ex a narcissist, it kind of makes it, I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for, but it kind of, yeah, it's not going to be very helpful, I think. And also, if you call someone a narcissist, no one wants to be called a narcissist, do they? It's not going to go down very well.
People say it as if it's negative, but it is not necessarily negative. You know, we all have some self-belief and self-interest, of course. You know, other, if we didn't, we wouldn't have any ambitions. We wouldn't have any desires. We wouldn't have any longings. So narcissism is quite a healthy trait, but it is important to know when it's destructive. It is important to recognize when you yourself are being harmed by a narcissist at work. So, you know, that's something else altogether. And if you aren't being harmed at work, then you need to take steps to protect yourself against a narcissist. You know, it might be that you need to leave, but, you know, if you don't want to ignite tensions with your narcissistic boss, then I'm afraid you'll have to find a way to go along with their agenda. You have to find what it is and go along with it. You know, a lot of people think, well, that's really unfair, but actually they can't take challenges. That's another kind of distinction between a productive and a pathological narcissist. A pathological narcissist can't take challenges, you know? So that's one way you can recognize one very soon. They can't control their emotions. So if you say anything to them that they might interpret as a threat to themselves or a challenge to their opinions, you know, they'll react aggressively. So the basic thing is to do is not do that. Don't challenge them. Don't criticize them. Don't blame them. Don't do the sorts of things that make them feel threatened. But if that is the reaction, then you know you're dealing with a pathological narcissist. And to be honest, oftentimes the best thing to do is to get out and find another job.
Okay.
Because on the extreme end, you have to know these people don't change.
Yeah. Yeah, I've spoken to a couple of therapists who will say, you know, the NHS you can't treat someone in the NHS for narcissism because it would just take too long and cost too much. And it's almost like, I don't know, do you think it's treatable at all? Or is it, you know, literally just need to get out?
Well, like I say, there's very few extreme narcissists in the workplace. They're actually very small proportion of the population. That's what people don't recognize. The people see a glimmer of narcissism and then label it as narcissism. But of course, you know, people on the kind of milder end or moderate end, of course they can learn. Oftentimes these people are very ambitious. So they, and one can learn empathy, of course, and one can develop interpersonal skills. And one can learn to hand over praise to underlings and not demand all the attention for oneself. You know, a lot of these things can be learned. And for people who have to deal with their narcissism on the more mild or moderate end, well, of course they can learn, but it's just the very extreme personalities that perhaps are so rigid and the personality structure is so extreme that oftentimes even therapy fails to help. So knowing where people lie on this continuum is the first thing to recognize.
So interesting. I'm sure everyone listening is going to be thinking about
about the narcissist in their life. Yeah.
Oh gosh. I wanted to ask you, I suppose, a bit more about your own personal kind of experience and how do you take care of your own mental well-being and your own mental health? Can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, of course I can. I'm happy to. Because I think the best thing is to develop a lifestyle, of course, where you are living more in balance, so that when setbacks or occurrences happen in life or in the workplace, you know, you can face what arises. And of course, I mean, I've done a lot of exploratory work in my own therapy, which has helped me to make sense of my experiences. I think you're asking more about a day-to-day practice. And there are several things I do as a daily practice. One is, which is I've never talked about, is I, in fact, also teach the Alexander technique, which is a way of teaching body use and body balance and coordination. So, you know, I find that looking after my physical use helps me mentally and emotionally to keep that balance. Once you can attain that physical balance, that helps you in your kind of overall well-being. So I teach and I also practice the Alexander technique on a regular basis. And I meditate. I practice transcendental meditation. So I meditate twice daily and have a lot of time. And I try to find time for a lot of fitness as well, and a lot of time in nature, and a lot of time to be outdoors. So that's what I do for my well-being.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, I do transcendental meditation too, and find it so helpful. And yeah. Is that Alexander technique, is that to do with kind of posture and breathing and things? Is that, because I'm just noticing how my posture is probably not very good. Just like, I need to sit up straight. But can you say a little bit more about what that is?
Well, it is about posture. It's learning to use your body correctly. It's kind of learning to use your body the way it's designed to be used. So it's not teaching breathing as such. You mentioned breathing. But of course, if you're using your body correctly, if your spine is lengthening and you have the width and the free muscle use and, you know, good muscle use and good postural use, breathing just does itself. It's perfectly natural. There's really nothing to learn. You know, the body's very intelligent and can do its own breathing without learning to do anything extra. But it's oftentimes the poor body use that interferes with good breathing.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I need to look into that more. Is there anything else that you want to share with listeners? Anything else about the book or any other takeaways that we haven't maybe spoken about that you wanted to share?
Well, you know, one of the things I'm hoping for the book, I mean, I'm hoping that people have a reaction like you've had, that they read some of these insights or read some of these case studies and stories, and that it touches a nerve and triggers something in them. I want people to reflect more about themselves, to consider where they come from, and also to be less harsh on themselves. I just find that people are so critical about their own habits and their own, I guess, what they imagine are their personal failings. But understanding oneself and understanding where some of these traits come from can really help you to have a bit more compassion with yourself. So what I really hope for with this book is that people will kind of expand their thinking, deepen their understanding, have all sorts of insights which find them interesting, and take them down various pathways that lead to more insights and more understandings. Because of course, this is an ongoing process. There's no end to this journey, if you like, of understanding oneself, of course. So I hope people will get curious. I hope they'll be interested. I hope they'll enjoy the book.
Brilliant, brilliant. And where can people find out more about you and get the book and that sort of thing?
Well, they can look at my website, naomishwagai.com. There's quite a lot of information there. I write regular features, occasional features now for the Financial Times. There's a feature out this morning about how our early childhood experiences influence our working lives. And it says some of the things that we've been talking about today.
Brilliant.
And the best way, of course, is to read the book.
Yeah, and the book's called The Man Who Mistook His Job for His Life. So thank you so much for everything you shared. It's been so interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been lovely to chat with you.
You have been listening to the Karma You podcast with me, Chloe Bretheridge. Don't forget, you can download loads of freebies for anxiety and confidence at my website, karmayou.com. You can also find out about my app and my one-on-one sessions. Please do subscribe to this podcast in the Apple Podcast app. And if you have enjoyed it or found it helpful, please leave me a review. It makes a massive difference to helping the podcast get discovered by other people. And come on over and find me on Instagram. I'm hanging out there every day. You can find me at Chloe Bretheridge. Let me know what you thought of this episode. And please do share it with anyone who might need to hear this today. So I'm sending you loads of love, and I hope you have a brilliant week ahead.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods
for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.